Like Theru, she said after a long pause. What's a child for? What's it there for? To be used? To be raped? To be gelded? Listen, Moss. When I lived in the dark places, that was what they did there. And when I came here, I thought I'd come out into the light. I learned the true words. And I had my man. I bore my children. I lived well. In the broad daylight. And in the broad daylight, they did that to the child. In the meadows by the river. The river that rises from the spring where Ogeon named my daughter. In the sunlight. I am trying to find out where I can live, Moss. Do you know what I mean? What I'm trying to say?
Well, well, the older woman said, and after a while, dearie, there's misery enough without going looking for it.
And seeing Tenar's hands shake as she tried to split a stubborn reed, she said again, don't cut your thumb on him, dearie. It was not till the next day that Ged roused at all. Moss, who was very skillful, though appallingly unclean as a nurse, had succeeded in spooning some meat broth into him.
Starving, she said, and dried up with thirst.
Wherever he was, they didn't do much eating and drinking. And after appraising him again, he'll be too far gone already, I think. They get weak, see, and can't even drink, though it's all they need. I've known a great strong man to die like that, all in a few days, shriveled to a shadow-like. But through relentless patience, she got a few spoonfuls of her brew of meat and herbs into him.
Ah, we'll see, she said. Too late, I guess. He's slipping away.
She spoke without regret, perhaps with relish. The man was nothing to her. A death was an event. Maybe she could bury this mage. They had not let her bury the old one. Tenar was salving his hands the next day when he woke. He must have ridden long on Kalesin's back, for his fierce grip on the iron scales had scoured the skin off his palms, and the inner side of his fingers was cut and recut. Sleeping, he kept his hands clenched, as if they would not let go of the absent dragon. She had to force his fingers open gently to wash and salve the sores. As she did that, he cried out and started, reaching out as if he felt himself falling. His eyes opened. She spoke quietly. He looked at her. Tenar, he said without smiling, in pure recognition beyond emotion. And it gave her pure pleasure, like a sweet flavor or a flower, that there was still one man living who knew her name, and that it was this man. She leaned forward and kissed his cheek. Lie still, she said. Let me finish this. He obeyed, drifting back into sleep soon, this time with his hands open and relaxed. Later, falling asleep beside Theru in the night, she thought, but I never kissed him before. And the thought shook her. At first, she disbelieved it. Surely, in all the years, not in the tombs, but after, traveling together in the mountains, in Lukfar, when they sailed together to Havnor, when he brought her here to Gaunt? No. Nor had Ogeon ever kissed her, or she him. He had called her daughter, and had loved her, but had not touched her. And she, brought up as a solitary, untouched priestess, a holy thing, had not sought touch, or had not known she sought it. She would lean her forehead or her cheek for a moment on Ogeon's open hand, and he might stroke her hair once, very lightly. And Ged, never even that. Did I never think of it? She asked herself in a kind of incredulous awe. She did not know. As she tried to think of it, a horror, a sense of transgression came on her very strongly, and then died away, meaningless. Her lips knew the slightly rough, dry, cool skin of his cheek near the mouth on the right side. And only that knowledge had importance, was of weight. She slept. She dreamed that a voice called her, Tenar! Tenar! And that she replied, crying like a seabird, flying in the light above the sea. But she did not know what name she called. Sparrowhawk disappointed Auntie Moss. He stayed alive. After a day or two, she gave him up for saved. She came and fed him her broth of goat's meat and roots and herbs, propping him against her, surrounding him with the powerful smell of her body, spooning life into him and grumbling. Although he had recognized her and called her by her use name, and she could not deny that he seemed to be the man called Sparrowhawk, she wanted to deny it. She did not like him. He was all wrong, she said. Tenar respected the witch's sagacity enough that this troubled her. But she could not find any such suspicion in herself, only the pleasure of his being there and of his slow return to life. "When he's himself again, you'll see," she said to Moss. "Himself," Moss said, and she made that gesture with her fingers of breaking and dropping a nutshell. He asked pretty soon about Ogeon. Tenar had dreaded that question. She had told herself and nearly convinced herself that he would not ask, that he would know, as mages knew, as even the wizards of Gauntport and Rhea Albi had known when Ogeon died. But on the fourth morning, he was lying awake when she came to him, and looking up at her, he said, "This is Ogeon's house." "Aye, Howl's house," she said, as easily as she could. It still was not easy for her to speak the mage's true name. She did not know if Ged had known that name. Surely he had. Ogeon would have told him, or had not needed to tell him. For a while he did not react, and when he spoke, it was without expression. "Then he is dead. 10 days ago." He lay looking before him as if pondering, trying to think something out. "When did I come here?" She had to lean close to understand him. 4 days ago, in the evening of the day." "There was no one else in the mountains," he said. Then his body winced and shuddered, as if in pain, or the intolerable memory of pain. He shut his eyes, frowning, and took a deep breath. As his strength returned little by little, that frown, the held breath, and clenched hands became familiar to Tenar. Strength returned to him, but not ease, not health. He sat on the doorstep of the house in the sunlight of the summer afternoon. It was the longest journey he had yet taken from the bed. He sat on the threshold, looking out into the day, and Tenar, coming around the house from the bean patch, looked at him. He still had an ashy, shadowy look to him. It was not the gray hair only, but some quality of skin and bone, and there was nothing much to him but that. There was no light in his eyes. Yet this shadow, this ashen man, was the same whose face she had seen first in the radiance of his own power, the strong face with hawk nose and fine mouth, a handsome man. He had always been a proud, handsome man. She came on towards him. "The sunlight's what you need," she said to him, and he nodded. But his hands were clenched as he sat in the flood of summer warmth. He was so silent with her that she thought maybe it was her presence that troubled him. Maybe he could not be at ease with her as he had used to be. He was archmage now, after all. She kept forgetting that. And it was 25 years since they had walked in the mountains of Atuan and sailed together in Lukfar across the eastern sea. "Where is Lukfar?" she asked suddenly, surprised by the thought of it, and then thought, "But how stupid of me. All those years ago, and he's archmage. He wouldn't have that little boat now." "In Salidar," he answered, his face set in its steady and incomprehensible misery. "As long ago as forever, as far away as Salidar." "The farthest island," she said. It was half a question. "The farthest west," he said. They were sitting at table, having finished the evening meal. Theru had gone outside to play. "It was from Salidar that you came, then, on Kalesin?" When she spoke the dragon's name again, it spoke itself, shaping her mouth to its shape and sound, making her breath soft fire. At the name, he looked up at her, one intense glance, which made her realize that he did not usually meet her eyes at all. He nodded. Then, with a laborious honesty, he corrected his assent. "From Salidar to Roque, and then from Roque to Gaunt." 1,000 miles? 10,000 miles? She had no idea. She had seen the great maps in the treasuries of Havnor, but no one had taught her numbers, distances. As far away as Salidar. And could the flight of a dragon be counted in miles? Ged, she said, using his true name since they were alone, I know you've been in great pain and peril. And if you don't want, maybe you can't, maybe you shouldn't tell me. But if I knew something of it, I'd be more help to you, maybe. I'd like to be. And they'll be coming soon from Roke for you, sending a ship for the Archmage. What do I know, sending a dragon for you. And you'll be gone again, and we'll never have talked. As she spoke, she clenched her own hands at the falseness of her tone and words. To joke about the dragon, to whine like an accusing wife. He was looking down at the table, sullen, enduring, like a farmer after a hard day in the fields, faced with some domestic squall. Nobody will come from Roke, I think, he said, and it cost him effort enough that it was a while before he went on. Give me time. She thought it was all he was going to say, and replied, Yes, of course, I'm sorry, and was rising to clear the table when he said, still looking down, not clearly, I have that now. Then he too got up and brought his dish to the sink and finished clearing the table. He washed the dishes while Tenar put the food away, and that interested her. She had been comparing him to Flint, but Flint had never washed a dish in his life. Women's work. But Ged and Ogeon had lived here, bachelors, without women. Everywhere Ged had lived, it was without women. So he did the women's work and thought nothing about it. It would be a pity, she thought, if he did think about it, if he started fearing that his dignity hung by a dishcloth. Nobody came for him from Roke. When they spoke of it, there had scarcely been time for any ship but one with the Mage Wind in her sails all the way. But the days went on, and still there was no message or sign to him. It seemed strange to her that they would let their archmage go untroubled so long. He must have forbidden them to send to him. Or perhaps he had hidden himself here with his wizardry so that they did not know where he was, and so that he could not be recognized. For the villagers paid curiously little attention to him still. That no one had come down from the mansion of the Lord of Realbi was less surprising. The lords of that house had never been on good terms with Ogeon. Women of the house had been, so the village tales went, adepts of dark arts. One had married a northern lord, they said, who buried her alive under a stone. Another had meddled with the unborn child in her womb, trying to make it a creature of power. And indeed, it had spoken words as it was born. But it had no bones. Like a little bag of skin, the midwife whispered in the village. A little bag with eyes and a voice, and it never sucked, but it spoke in some strange tongue and died. Whatever the truth of such tales, the lords of Realbi had always held aloof. Companion of the mage, Sparrowhawk, ward of the mage, Ogeon, bringer of the ring of Aerith Akbi to Havnor, Tenar might have been asked to stay, it would seem, at the mansion house when she first came to Realbi. But she had not. She had lived instead, to her own delight, alone in a tiny cottage that belonged to the village weaver, Fan, and she saw the people of the great house seldom and at a distance. There was now no lady of the house at all, Moss told her, only the old lord, very old, and his grandson, and the young wizard called Aspen, whom they had hired from the school on Roke. Since Ogeon was buried with Auntie Moss's talisman in his hand under the beech tree by the mountain path, Tenar had not seen Aspen. Strange as it seemed, he did not know the Archmage of Earthsea was in his own village, or if he knew it, for some reason kept away. And the wizard of Gauntport, who had also come to bury Ogeon, had never come back either. Even if he did not know that Ged was here, surely he knew who she was, the white lady, who had worn the ring of Aerith Akbi on her wrist, who had made whole the rune of peace. And how many years ago was that, old woman, she said to herself. Is your nose out of joint? All the same, it was she who had told him Ogeon's true name. It seemed some courtesy was owing. But wizards as such had nothing to do with courtesy. They were men of power. It was only power that they dealt with. And what power had she now? What had she ever had? As a girl, a priestess, she had been a vessel, The power of the dark places had run through her, used her, left her empty, untouched. As a young woman, she had been taught a powerful knowledge by a powerful man and had laid it aside, turned away from it, not touched it. As a woman, she had chosen and had the powers of a woman in their time, and the time was past. Her wiving and mothering was done. There was nothing in her, no power, for anybody to recognize. But a dragon had spoken to her.
"I am Kalesin," it had said, and she had answered, "I am Tenar."
"What is a dragon lord?" she had asked Ged in the dark place, the labyrinth, trying to deny his power, trying to make him admit hers, and he had answered with the plain honesty that forever disarmed her. "A man dragons will talk to." So she was a woman dragons would talk to. Was that the new thing, the folded knowledge, the light seed that she felt in herself, waking beneath the small window that looked west? A few days after that brief conversation at table, she was weeding Ogeon's garden patch, rescuing the onions he had set out in spring from the weeds of summer. Ged let himself in the gate in the high fence that kept the goats out and set to weeding at the other end of the row. He worked a while and then sat back, looking down at his hands. "Let them have time to heal," Tenar said mildly. He nodded. The tall, staked bean plants in the next row were flowering. Their scent was very sweet. He sat with his thin arms on his knees, staring into the sunlit tangle of vines and flowers and hanging bean pods. She spoke as she worked. "When Ai-Hal died, he said, all changed. And since his death, I've mourned him. I've grieved, but something lifts up my grief. Something is coming to be born, has been set free. I know in my sleep, in my first waking, something is changed." "Yes," he said. "An evil ended. And..." After a long silence, he began again. He did not look at her, but his voice sounded for the first time like the voice she remembered, easy, quiet, with the dry, gauntish accent. "Do you remember, Tenar, when we came first to Havnor?" "Would I forget?" her heart said, but she was silent for fear of driving him back into silence. "We brought Lukfar in and came up onto the quay. The steps are marble. And the people, all the people. And you held up your arm to show them the ring. And held your hand. I was terrified beyond terror. The faces, the voices, the colors, the towers, and the flags and banners, the gold and silver and music. And all I knew was you. In the whole world, all I knew was you, there by me as we walked. The stewards of the king's house brought us to the foot of the tower of Ereth Akbe, through the streets full of people. And we went up the high steps, the two of us, alone. Do you remember?" She nodded. She laid her hands on the earth she had been weeding, feeling its grainy coolness. "I opened the door. It was heavy, it stuck at first, and we went in. Do you remember?" It was as if he asked for reassurance. Did it happen? Do I remember? "It was a great high hall," she said. "It made me think of my hall, where I was eaten, but only because it was so high. The light came down from windows away up in the tower, shafts of sunlight crossing like swords." "And the throne," he said. "The throne, yes, all gold and crimson, but empty, like the throne in the hall in Atuan." "Not now," he said. He looked across the green shoots of onion at her. His face was strained, wistful, as if he named a joy he could not grasp. "There is a king in Havnor," he said, "at the center of the world. What was foretold has been fulfilled. The rune is healed, and the world is whole. The days of peace have come." He stopped and looked down, clenching his hands. "He carried me from death to life. Aran of Enlad, Libanon of the songs to be sung. He has taken his true name, Libanon, King of Earthsea." "Is that it, then?" she asked, kneeling, watching him. "The joy, the coming into light?" He did not answer. "A king in Havnor," she thought, and said aloud, A king in Havnor. The vision of the beautiful city was in her, the wide streets, the towers of marble, the tiled and bronze roofs, the white-sailed ships in harbor, the marvelous throne room where sunlight fell like swords, the wealth and dignity and harmony, the order that was kept there. From that bright center, she saw order going outward like the perfect rings on water, like the straightness of a paved street or a ship sailing before the wind, a going the way it should go, a bringing to peace. "You did well, dear friend," she said. He made a little gesture as if to stop her words, and then turned away, pressing his hand to his mouth. She could not bear to see his tears. She bent to her work. She pulled a weed and another, and the tough root broke. She dug with her hands, trying to find the root of the weed in the harsh soil in the dark of the earth.